Twofootedtackle.com.
Yes, it's Two Footed Tackle podcast time, and we're getting serious as a ravaged war zone asks if it wants anything more to do with Americans stepping in and running an organisation where they're not particularly wanted, and as well if Ryan Babel really is a weapon of mass destruction. Yes, we're discussing all things Liverpool. We'll also be looking at the MLS, international football, and bad tackling in the Premier League, as we most definitely are that type of podcast. So, welcome to the Two Footed Tackle podcast with me, Gary Andrews, joining the veritable banquet that is this week's pod. For starters, the light and frothy Chris Nee.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
I've been better, but I'm up for a good evening's football chat.
Excellent, that's what we like to hear. Battling in through, despite the fact that you'll be hacking away throughout the pod.
Yeah, I'll try and sneak off into a corner if I do need to cough up a lung.
Excellent, good stuff. For the main course, the bold and brassy yet comforting flavours of journalist and Liverpool fan Sam Corr.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing, Sam?
I'm good, that was an awful introduction.
They get worse. For dessert, the sweet yet smooth finishing of the cynical challenges, James Appel.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, that was very enthusiastic.
Well, you just called me a dessert, which is very nice. I was thinking on the way here, having read that you were going to be saying that, about which dessert I would prefer to be.
Okay.
Spotted dick and custard.
Classic. Absolutely.
Sticky toffee pudding.
See a doctor all that first time there.
Right in. Email in. Two for a tackle.
If James Appel was a dessert, what type of dessert would he be? Listeners, this is the most important thing in football at the moment. We want your comments on that one. To round it all off, the cheese board of strong and mature opinions from journalist and Liverpool fan Chris Geordie White.
Mature.
I do have a bit of a Stiltony Pong. Hello, Gary.
Hello. How are you doing, Geordie?
Dancing with joy.
Excellent. I'm very glad to hear. Okay, right, to business. And if business has been hitting the front page of all today's papers, chiefly the business of Liverpool FC and their ongoing boardroom sagas. The sale deadline looms large as Liverpool's owners George Gillette and Tom Hicks dig their feet in at the proposed sale to the owner of the Boston Red Sox baseball team. It's all moving fast in a direct pass exposing Glenn Johnson's positioning, so anything we say now may actually be out of date when you, dear listener, come to this pod. But as things stand, as we're recording, Geordie, what's your current take on the proposed sale?
Well, I'm not actually dancing with joy. I'm sort of cautiously optimistic. It's nice to finally get the change in ownership that we've been looking for a long time. The only question is where all the money is coming from. John Henry is rumoured to be worth around £500 to £600 million. The sale of the club is going to cost him at least £300 million. And then he's said that he wants to invest in players, which would be nice, and build a new stadium, so he's going to have to borrow money somewhere. That might cause a lot of fans to poo themselves a little bit, but obviously borrowing to fund the cost of a stadium is an entirely different matter to borrowing to take control of the club in the first place. And he's not Hicks and Gillette, and frankly I'd take Osama bin Laden right now over either of them.
What in terms of Henry, you look at his record at the Boston Red Sox, a lot of people seem to be saying he has been a good owner for them, despite a bit of hostility, a bit of caution when he first took over. Does that encourage you at all?
Not really. Baseball is an entirely different sport to football, and American sports in general, with, you know, wage caps and the drafting systems, I don't think it necessarily needs an owner to put in as much money as football these days does, and he's not going to be a sort of Abramovich or a Sheikh What's-His-Face type of owner. That's so racist, I just forgot the city owner's name. Sorry.
Sam, Tom Hicks is obviously digging his feet in to hang on for as long as possible. What can you see that he could possibly gain from opposing that sale?
Absolutely nothing. It's kind of, at the moment, it's akin to a man that's sitting in the electric chair waiting to die, shitting himself just to piss off the people that have to clean it up afterwards. That's all he's really doing. He's just delaying the inevitable, really. He's a dead man walking, and all the better for it.
Do you think he might hold it up to the point where cop holdings have to go into administration, necessarily temporarily?
It's one of the things that's been mooted as a possibility. I mean, the Premier League have initially stated that it wouldn't affect the club. So if that's the case, then albeit put them into administration now for all I care. It'll get them out quicker.
Do you think Geordie's obviously said that, you know, cautious, but they're not Hicks and Gillette. Is that your feeling on John Henry as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit more optimistic than Geordie. I mean, it's obviously not just
generally.
It's not just John Henry behind this. You know, the New England Sports Ventures, I think that's... Is that the exact name of it? You know, it's rumoured to be made up of as many as 18 people with money involved. So a little bit more optimistic on the finance front. But, you know, obviously if you've been burnt once, then you're going to be careful the next time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think every Liverpool fan is cautious in a sense. But there is optimism. And for the first time in a long while, there's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel.
James, as a neutral observer looking in, where do you see Liverpool going now? Because there is progress, which there didn't seem to be this time last week.
Well, I may be a neutral, but I've seen my own club go almost to the wall a couple of times in the last decade or so. So I'm, if not, you know, feeling the same emotions as Sam and Chris right now, and certainly empathise. The key is that Liverpool's problems aren't just off the field, and people seem to have forgotten in the furore and hullabaloo about Hicks and Gillette and the proposed sale that things on the field have been absolutely shocking this season. Even as a neutral viewer, I'm amazed at how poor Liverpool have performed at times this year. I'm amazed, for example, that the defending against Blackpool, and we may come to the game at Blackpool later in the pod, but the defending was shocking. Midfield wasn't covering the defenders. Fernando Torres obviously went off, but for the 9 minutes he was on, it really didn't instill any confidence whatsoever. In short, for the future, this isn't going to be a problem that is resolved the day that Hicks and Gillette walk out the door and someone else, whether it is John W. Henry or anyone else, is still obviously yet to be resolved, but it's not a problem that's going to go away overnight, because they clearly need massive investment in the playing staff. They need to overhaul something of a kind of rut that the dressing room seems to have got into. Everyone seems to be complaining about Hodgson's tactics and complaining about the general style of play that is being seen at Anfield at the moment. That doesn't turn itself around overnight, and so this isn't, you know, if a sale goes through the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning.
Got a question here from one of our listeners. Random Ventures asks, if these US owners are so mad keen on football, why don't they buy an MLS team? Or is it too weighed down with regulations and the salary cap and the like? I'll throw that out to Chris as our resident MLS expert.
Well, regulation is probably part of it. One of those regulations is it costs $40 million just to get a franchise after you've prove that you have the money to do the soccer specific stadium and the infrastructure and all sorts. There's probably a paucity of worthwhile markets left. There are a few. A lot of those are taken and kind of lined up for the future anyway. And then yes, the regulations, salary caps, the drafting system, as you mentioned before, and there just isn't the egotistical and financial value that you would get out of a Premier League club. So yeah, it's limited opportunities and limited benefit.
John Henry has said that he'd be looking to develop, possibly redevelop Anfield, like he's done with the Red Sox stadium, possibly a new stadium. Sam, do you think that's a viable option, redeveloping Anfield?
In its current condition, and you know, being a regular Anfield for quite a long time, I don't see Anfield as redevelopable. It's largely boxed in, albeit by terraced houses, which are unoccupied, could easily be knocked down, but I don't really see that as an option, to be honest. You know, I see, you know, Spurs are quite comparable in what they're doing about talking to refinance White Hart Lane, where they have an easy option where they could go and play in the Olympic Stadium for a year while that's happening. There's just no scope for that at Anfield. You know, while it's getting developed, you'd be having a club that's playing in front of minimal amount of fans while that's happening. And to be honest, the incentives to build a new stadium as opposed to just redevelop Anfield itself are huge. The money that's coming from the council, from local trust funds to redevelop the whole area itself that comes with the new stadium, is something that really needs to be pushed through for the benefit of the city as well as the club. So I still see the new stadium, whatever form and size that it comes in as being something that the new owners would have to face up to, albeit in the short run or the long term.
Geordie, would you have a countenance sharing with Everton? Because obviously they're looking for a new ground.
No.
Do you think? I mean, do you think it should be an option though on the table? Because you look at those two teams, they've both got in, both looking to redevelop their stadiums. Seen it can work in other countries as well with sharing.
Other countries aren't England, and I think there's an element of club pride in having your own stadium, and obviously there's the revenue for it. And Everton are the enemy.
Not as much as Manchester United.
That goes without saying.
Okay, well, let's turn our attention to on the pitch. James, as you alluded to earlier, you haven't thought Liverpool have been good enough. I mean, Roy Hodgson doesn't go from winning Manager of the Year and taking Fulham to a Europa League final and then becoming a bad manager overnight. So, you know, was he right to take the job? Were Liverpool right to appoint him? What's gone wrong there?
Well, in the short term, got to say no, he wasn't right to take the job, that year. I said it rather flippantly when on Twitter that I felt like if Hodgson had stuck around at Fulham a couple more seasons, he'd have a knighthood. I'm not so flippant anymore. I think that, you know, the way that he was being feted by people all over the game and even people outside the game as being, you know, a paragon of a great English manager and somebody who'd gone out and plied their trade elsewhere. And you know, I saw a great video earlier this week of Roy Hodgson as a 28-year-old managing Halmstads in Sweden, speaking fluent Swedish. You know, this is already 30 years ago. I mean, this is a guy who is a great example to managers. He doesn't turn into a bad manager overnight, you're right. And I really do think, had he stuck around at Fulham, he could have taken them to, you know, the pinnacle of all their... Well, he already had them, but, you know, he could have kept them there, basically. Instead, he decided to take this job at Liverpool, which obviously he considered kind of a final hurrah, his last chance to manage a big club. We know what happened last time he did that. He went to Blackburn. The club fell away really badly under him. And I just wonder whether Hodgson struggles to get teams of stars playing, you know, really well together. I know that there's a notable exception. He has managed big teams. I think he was at Inter, wasn't he? But that's an exception in his managerial CV. And I just think he's entered a dressing room with people like Steven Gerrard, Fernando Torres, Jamie Carragher, Jose Reina. You know, they aren't necessarily going to be the kinds of players who are prepared to sit down and relearn the game under a new manager. They're the sorts of players who've been used to having it all their own way. I think that is... I mean, I'd like to hear from the two Liverpool fans here whether they think that, you know, to a certain extent, it's those players who perhaps have been an obstacle for Hodgson, or whether you think that there's something else afoot here.
I'll throw it to Geordie first.
I think it's something else, and I think that something else is that he's a clown. I commented elsewhere a few weeks ago that Hodgson doesn't know what he's doing, which was obviously hyperbole in the wake of that immiserating defeat to Northampton Town. But it's funny, you know, to mention the fact that he was being so feted as manager of the season and off the back of his Europa League final with Fulham, because a lot of the same people who dismiss Rafa Benitez's win in Istanbul as lucky are exactly the same ones who assume that because Hodgson can get to a Europa League final, that somehow must mean he's a talented manager. He has had a reasonable record, a mixed record, but there was a few things that sort of made me wary of him at Liverpool. The first was that he somehow expected Fernando Torres to regain his form and fitness from the bench, whereas, you know, a run out against the likes of Northampton and Stoa might have done him the world of good. I mean, there's only so much confidence you can regain playing against bin men and gypsies, but it would have helped. The second was defending against Manchester United a few weeks ago, and this time last year, all the punditocracy could talk about was Liverpool's poor defending of set pieces under Benitez's zonal marking. And then a year later, we have a new manager in, and instead of spending his time sorting out simple problems like that, we concede a corner against our most fierce rivals, and the man tasked with marking an opposition forward is our forward, Fernando Torres. If he can't be bothered to sort out simple problems that could stop us from conceding goals, then he's not doing his job properly. And the other thing was his signings, and the likes of Christian Poulsen are just not good enough. Until last season I'd been extremely sceptical of Lucas, as Sam would be able to tell you. We've had many a heated debate about that, and I came around last season and recognised that he's actually a perfectly capable defensive midfielder. He was the fourth most prolific tackler in the league last season, and he's been replaced by Paulson, who Sam told me off camera, as it were, he failed to put in a single tackle against Birmingham a few weeks ago. And in two seasons at Juventus, Paulson played only five league games more than Lucas did in his first two seasons at Liverpool, when obviously he was in the shadow of Xabi Alonso. And I just think, if we're going, and Juventus, like Liverpool, finished seventh in their domestic league last season, if we're going to be buying second choice players, they should be from a better team, like Spurs and Van der Vaart. And don't get me started on Konchesky either.
Okay, well, Sam, Hodgson started slowly at Fulham. We saw that. It took a bit of time for the players to adjust to his training regime. Once they came round to it, Fulham then started moving up. Do you think Hodgson deserves time to turn it round? The new owner, or prospective new owners, have said, for the time being, they're not going to replace him. Do you think he deserves that time just to bed in? It's only been a few weeks in there. You know, would it really do any good changing the manager?
No, it wouldn't do any good changing the manager, but I don't think that takes away from the fact that he's not the right manager for us at the moment. I remember speaking before, you know, I was a staunch Benitez supporter before, but even I could recognise at the end of last season it was quite possibly time for him to leave. And they've just simply made the wrong appointment. I said at the time, he's not the right appointment. It's not a question of whether he's gone from being a bad manager overnight. He was never the right manager in the first place. He's never been a good enough manager for Liverpool. And the sort of problems that rumoured to come out the dressing room and player influence that led to Benitez's demise, and why certain players are playing in certain positions at the moment, even though they should either not be anywhere near the first team, a la Jamie Carragher, or continually prove themselves incapable of playing central midfield, a la Steven Gerrard, it's mystifying and it's baffling. To go with Geordie, it's not so much what we're seeing on the pitch and think, okay, we lose at home to Blackpool, because teams do lose at home. They do lose to worse teams. Football would be pointless unless you had surprises in football. It's the manner of which we're losing these games. We're starting a £12 million central midfielder that he signed on the right wing in Raul Morelos, and Hodgson's come out and said, I don't know what his best position is. Why are you spending £12 million on a player that you openly say, I don't know where to play him? When you're chasing a game at Blackpool with 5 minutes to go, we're playing Raul Morelos at left back, Gerrard at centre half, and Kyriakos up front. And it's mind-blowing, and that's the thing that's alarming more than anything. It's not whether Hodgson needs time or things like this. There's no light to say that Hodgson is going to get this right. At the moment, he's getting it spectacularly wrong. We're in a relegation zone for a reason.
What about Dalglish, though? I mean, a lot of people are calling for... It's not that bad, Chris.
Sorry.
A lot of people are calling for Dalglish. A lot of Liverpool fans were chanting his name at the end of that. But is Dalglish just going to be your version of Keegan or Shearer up at Newcastle? Because he's not been in the game for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn on the sort of two levels. I could see that he'd bring back some pride and some attacking mentality to a side that, you know, has always played good passing, attacking football. He would bring that back successfully or unsuccessfully, we don't know. And at the moment, Liverpool fans just want to see some passion and some pride in the shirt on the pitch, because, you know, we'll forgive poor performances, we'll forgive players that try but aren't maybe up to the grade, as long as we see them giving their all. And what we see at the moment is 11 players who don't really seem to give a crap about playing for the club. And these are, you know, these go from players that have been here for 2 months, like Christian Poulsen, and that have been here for their whole career, like Steven Gerrard. And what we're seeing just isn't good enough. And Dalglish would bring that back, but also, as you know, I think the call for Dalglish is in the way a bit misty-eyed, and it's a call for those old traditions and the old football we used to play under him in the late 80s, as opposed to for him as a person. So no, I don't think he's the right person to come in now. I don't think it would achieve anything sacking Hodgson and bringing him in now. But I think the board got it spectacularly wrong in the summer, and we're living with those decisions now.
Mm. Jordy, did you see Torres or Gerrard sticking around?
No. Gerrard, possibly because he's not really got anywhere else to go, given his age and it looks like his decline has started already, to be perfectly honest. But that might, again, just be an effect of being played in funny positions, and the whole team looked quite world-weary. Glenn Johnson was at fault for both goals against Blackpool and looked like a lost child. But Torres is clearly going to be off, unfortunately.
Where's he going? Who's going to want him in the condition and form he's in? Who's going to want him? Seriously,
I'm sure they will.
Leeds, I wouldn't mind.
The money that would take to buy him in January. We're not talking about the summer when players move freely and replacements are available. We're talking January, which comes with a January premium to replace him. Who's going to want to spend that money on?
Well, I wasn't thinking January.
Let's be clear. It may come to it in January if this deal doesn't go through to sell the club. That the banks might be pushing Liverpool to sell players even at cut price.
Possibly so. I mean, I don't think it's. I think in January it's going to take upwards to 50 million.
You say that, but I mean, you know, I can remember Leeds going down the pan and having to sell Jonathan Woodgate in January for 9 million to Newcastle. And
but Jonathan Woodgate wasn't the best striker in the world. He wasn't the best in his position at the world.
I mean at that time. Obviously, it's a comparison. I think at the time Jonathan Woodgate was one of the most highly rated defenders certainly in England. So. Perhaps not the right comparison to draw, but certainly I would warn against the idea that Torres is not going anywhere and no club would want him. I think that any club would want him, and he has a price, and it will have an even cheaper price.
I expect him to leave.
If things keep going the way they are.
I do expect him to leave, but I don't expect all of these.
Class is permanent, isn't it? You assume that a top manager will believe that they'll be able to turn him around if he leaves. I don't think he'll leave in January. I think he'll leave in the summer. I think he's going to move. Yeah.
I think he's going to have to take a step down rather than to a big up. Yeah. We were talking before we started the show, he probably will end up back in Spain, but it's not going to be with Real or Barcelona.
I mean, yeah, let's look at where he's not going to go to United. That just won't happen. No. Like, anywhere under the sun, that's not going to happen. Barcelona he might go to, they've just spent a lot of money on the one forward they're going to play up front on their own. Well, he ain't going to Real Madrid. That's
they're spending stratospheric amounts of money, and Torres on current form isn't going to fit into that plan.
The only two places you'd say he's going to go,
Chelsea.
Is Man City. I don't think Chelsea would touch him.
I can see him not very much going to Man City.
I think he'd go to Inter Milan or Man City. And does he want to work with Benitez again? Who knows? He was the most, you know, Torres was the most silent over anyone over Benitez's departure. The one thing he said was it was probably right that he left given the ownership situation, which is the most guarded comment you can make. Or he could go to City.
I don't think you can read too much into that. He's been fairly quiet. He doesn't really talk to the press himself that much, apart from when he came out with that statement that he was staying at the end of the summer. All the talk of his injury problems and is he going to find the net again? Dirk Kuyt seems to be speaking for him over the past few weeks. But it looked to me, I don't know if this is an indication that he wants to leave, whether in January or the summer, but it looked to me like him and Steven Gerrard had a bit of a falling out in the Blackpool game.
How much of Torres' form is down to all of this going round in his head, and how much of it is just simple box standard tiredness?
I think it's fitness. He doesn't look fit. He doesn't look match sharp.
No,
it's almost 3 years, isn't it, since he had a proper non-injury based rest?
Yeah. I think it's a bit of both, because as I said, the whole team look really world weary, and like they know that this is going on around them. They don't know what's going to be happening, and it's obviously, I mean, I remember the season that we finished second, 4 points behind Man United, a few weeks before the end of the season. We were 0-0 for most of the game against Fulham, and Sam and I were talking about this the other week, and we scored a winner in the last minute of the game to keep us in the title race. And the whole last 20 minutes, half an hour of that game, Sam and I were watching that one together, and we were both really anxious. And now, watching every game feels like that all the time. Or it does to me.
That's like supporting other clubs.
No kidding. Okay. In the midst of all this, we'll wrap because we've got plenty to get through. But in the midst of all this, Chris, did I not say last week that Blackpool I saw as a potential upset against certainly Liverpool did. And everybody else went, nah.
Yeah, chiefly myself. Congratulations.
Not that I take any pride, I put no money on it. But
That's been the sort of game that Liverpool lose for the last 10 years. Yeah. Like, it's not. I don't even know why anyone's surprised when they lost to Blackpool.
Credit though, Chris, just while we finish up on there, and on a positive note, not necessarily for Liverpool, but Ian Holloway's done a fantastic job there. Everybody's talking about Liverpool and the crisis they're in, but take nothing away from that. That was a good performance.
That's a great result. At the end of the start of a great season, so they're doing very well. They obviously don't look in trouble at the moment, and the longer they stay out of looking like they're in trouble, the further away they'll be from it at the end of the season.
Brilliant stuff. Okay, right, well, still loads to get through. Unlike Hicks and Gillette, we will probably be sticking with the Premier League. We'll be looking at all the weekend's action in part two. A lot to get through, so good luck Le Pod fitting it all in. Break a leg, as Nigel de Jong might say. Part two of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Chris, you've got an announcement.
Yeah, well, regular readers of the blog will know that we've partnered with a charity called Cardiac Risk in the Young, which was set up in 1995 to raise awareness of conditions that can lead to sudden death syndrome. And as part of that, I want to give them £1,000 at Christmas as an introductory donation. So the challenge is to basically make a grand for Cardiac Risk in the Young by getting, I guess, 500 people to give £2, purely because it's done on Just Giving. And I discovered when donating myself that it doesn't let you just give a quid, so it's doubled what I'm asking, but it still isn't very much, and it's hopefully half the number of people that we need to be generous. But whatever happens, I'm hoping to give a significant amount of money to them at Christmas as a golden handshake on the way in.
Fantastic stuff. All details on the blog?
Yeah, details are on a blog at twofootedtackle.com/cry, and the Just Giving page is justgiving.com/twofootedtackle.
Wonderful stuff. If you're listening, please get on there. Please donate. You can donate £2. You can donate more if you're that way inclined. Please do. Wonderful course. Okay, right. Premier League. Apart from Liverpool, lots of talking points this weekend. Let's start with Chelsea against Arsenal. James, do you think Arsene Wenger still suffers from recurring nightmares involving Didier Drogba after they went down 2-0?
I'm sure he does. That's 13-13 for Drogba against Arsenal. That is unbelievable, Jeff. I have to say that the goal he scored as well, I don't know how much of it was he meant to do it, and how much of it was, I've just sort of knocked it in, I'll do a little pirouette and then run into the advertising hoardings and it'll look like I meant to do some kind of clever turn and shot. But either way, great goal, fantastic finish. Drogba, again, is unstoppable in the Premier League.
Well, if you talk about good goals, Alex's goal from the free kick for Chelsea's second was just unstoppable. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, you say unstoppable, but if you notice, I think it was Malouda in the wall kind of standing there. Why does this happen so often that there's an opposition player in the wall?
Oops. Here we go.
That was a Freudian slip.
Two-footedtackle.com for all your xenophobic needs. Carry on, James.
Anyway, to return to the theme, Malouda, being both foreign and an opposition player, stands in the wall, moves out of the way, and the ball goes straight through the gap that he's left. That sort of makes it stoppable, if you ask me, Gary. But great strike either way. Once it actually got past the wall, there was no chance the keeper stopping it.
And then, I mean, well, for all Arsenal people sort of complaining, or Arsenal fans complaining again, this to me felt like a better performance than they put in last year against Chelsea. It feels like they're slowly edging there, but Chelsea just look too good defensively.
Look, Arsenal only know how to play one way. They get the ball down, they play lovely football. I'm not going to talk about it as pretty football, because that is very patronising. I think that they play great football. Unfortunately, against a team like Chelsea, and very often against the other top four teams, you need a different approach. You need to be slightly more conservative. You need to get more men behind the ball. You probably, I hasten to say this, given that we're going to be talking about bad tackles later on, need to be a bit more physical. And Arsenal really don't have a plan B, if you ask me. I don't think Arsene Wenger sent them out against Chelsea with instructions anything, you know, different from how he would send them out against Blackpool at the Emirates. So, to my mind, Arsenal may have performed really well, but they're getting outthought. It's not outfought and outplayed, it's outthought, and that's really the difference between them winning the title and coming in second, third, fourth, and it happens every season.
And elsewhere in the Premier League, Chris, Villa going down to Spurs, what did you make of that?
Yeah, pretty disappointing. It seems as if Mr. Heskey's substitution had a big bearing on that game, because he's in decent form. And he helps us keep the ball, which is used to be the criticism levelled at him, with John Carew being the man that we could use to make sure that the ball was held up at the top. But it was all about Van der Vaart, really, in the end. He got a decent header for the first one, and the second one, despite my criticism of the Match Today commentator, was a lovely goal. At the moment, I just think Spurs are better than us. I don't think it's a surprising result. I'm not especially disappointed by it. And those are the games where we really have to pick up our game to get a result.
Okay, well, I mean, still early days, Chris. Still very early days indeed. Looking else throughout there, Sam, Manchester United drawing with Sunderland. Again, we say this every week, they just can't seem to kick on. They can't seem to get into gear at the moment. That's a game that you think they would have at least troubled the goalkeeper a bit more than they did.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a United supporting friend of mine the other day, who, you know, a rare breed for Man United fans, isn't a complete arsehole. And we were talking about how just this is probably the first time in 10, 12 years that you could say that it's a United team that suffers from a lack of ideas. And that, I think that's the most alarming thing for Ferguson at the moment, is that it's not a case of them just coming into a brick wall and just not being able to get their goal. It's the fact they haven't looked like doing so. And I think, you know, this season, I think his biggest regret is going to be not signing an attacking midfielder or a creative midfielder, someone like a Van der Vaart, who's gone so cheaply. And you look at the midfield combinations that United can put out in Anderson and Fletcher and Carrick, who he's just got no faith in whatsoever, Scholes and Giggs. You've either got ageing legs there, or you have players who aren't particularly creative. You know, they're destructive players, and they're going to be fine when you're swamping a game, but they're not going to win you a game on their own. And if you contrast it to 10 years ago, and you'd look anywhere in that United midfield, and any single one of those people were match winners. And now none of them, I wouldn't say any of them are going to go out and win you a game on their own in the way that Beckham could with a free kick, or Giggs could with a run, or Scholes could with a drive. It's just not going to happen anymore. And beyond Berbatov and Nani when he wants to, and Rooney when his head's right, I don't see a lot of match winners in that United team, and I think that's quite alarming for United fans.
James, you're Birmingham. If you were a Birmingham City fan, your team's just lost for the first time in probably thousands of years at home to Everton, who, despite their position, are not a bad side. And you boo the manager off the pitch. I mean, that, to me, seems crazy for Blues fans.
Well, you said if I were a Birmingham fan. Well, the answer is, if I were a Birmingham fan, I wouldn't have booed Alex McLeish off the pitch, or the players. They have come on so well, and it is a sign of expectations at that club, that from, you know, promotion to the Premier League, they're now disappointed with anything less than, you know, a home victory or a draw against the big boys. They're a very good team, Birmingham, I have to say. They added really, really well on the transfer deadline with Hleb and Beau Sejour and Juranek. And I can see them challenging for European places, but obviously 2-0 defeat at home to Everton. Obviously, no mugs themselves, but just, you know, might give them a kick up the backside coming into the next round of fixtures.
A couple of 1-1 draws for Chris to very quickly mention. Not that we like to gloss over some of the teams, but West Brom still continuing very well with their nice little run. Point against Bolton's decent, and Clint Dempsey becoming Robert Green's nemesis yet again, as Fulham and West Ham enjoyed a 1-1 draw.
Yeah, Piquion's looking like a bargain, isn't he? Another header, another equaliser, so nice little buy.
Absolutely, and I know I've been asking about the Baggies a lot, but do you think that was a good point for them, or do you think they could have taken all three?
No, I think it's decent. I think dropping points here and there is par for the course when you're probably aiming for mid-table. So yeah, it's a decent start, and it continues to be that despite what you know is a winnable game at home to Bolton.
Well, I've left two games out deliberately till last. Wigan's 2-0 victory over Wolves, and Manchester City, who laboured, I think you could say, to a 2-1 victory over Newcastle. I was very, very impressed with Newcastle, actually. I watched that game and I thought Newcastle were unlucky not to get a point out of that. Obviously, both games overshadowed. In the Manchester City case, Nigel de Jong's tackle that broke Hatem Ben Arfa's leg, no punishment there. And in Wigan, Carl Henry getting sent off after 10 minutes for, not in really a tackle, more an assault on Jordi Gomez. Now that's turned into the big talking point. Jordi, we know from previous history, both these, you could probably say, are that type of player. But do you think this... this tackling thing has now just become the moral panic of the day for the Premier League, or do you think there genuinely is a bigger issue at stake here?
A little from column A, a little from column B. Tackling's obviously an important part of the game, and it's kind of like what James was saying before about Arsenal only knowing how to play one way and have to change their game to play against essentially better teams. And that's one of for me one of the best things about football is the kind of different way you can go about winning a game. So you can be a slightly less skillful team can beat an Arsenal by being more physical, and that's what, in my opinion, what makes football more interesting than a lot of other sports. But obviously tackles like De Jong's, I haven't seen Carl Henry's, but I saw De Jong's and it was absolutely horrendous and stupid. I think maybe there's a case for them where they are that obviously reckless being punished a little more strongly with an extended ban.
Sam, De Jong's been dropped from the Holland squad for his tackle on Ben Arfa, yet the referee saw nothing wrong with it. How do you explain that one?
I didn't see a huge amount wrong with that. I think Ben Arfa's unlucky, and I think it's, you know, it came at an incredibly unlucky time where this thing's already starting to be talked about. But I think it's bizarre that a Dutch manager whose approach to a World Cup final was to kick the other team out of the game is now dropping members of his squad for, well, kicking people out of the game. It seems a little bizarre. But, I was talking about this afternoon, and I think it's a lot of hot wind over really nothing, to be honest. It's unfortunate that a couple of these things have happened in very quick succession. But worse tackles than De Jong's go unpunished and players go uninjured in every single game, every single week. And, you know, De Jong's been dropped from the Dutch squad. Sodsloth says when he's recalled he'll injure someone in the next game he plays, because that's just what's going to happen, whether he's trying to or not. We'll be on to something else in 2 months' time. Another ball across the line and a goal won't be given, and we'll be back to that, and everyone will have forgotten the fact that a couple of people misplaced a couple of tackles in an incredibly fast-paced game.
I think that that World Cup final, the Spain-Holland final, is probably the best example of exactly the kind of thing that I mean, like the physical team playing the skillful team. But the interesting thing about De Jong's tackle on Ben Arfa was that it's not that kind of mismatch where Man City were the stronger team, at least on paper. So I think perhaps he's just completely brainless.
James, what's your opinion on the tackling? Because we've had sort of both sides on De Jong there, and you know, to me, I saw that being something which was, on another day, if it had been in a slightly different direction, he probably wouldn't have caught Ben Arfa. Do you think that De Jong should have been dropped? Do you think this is a big problem in the Premier League at the moment with the spate of broken leg injuries we had? Or do you agree with Sam that it's something that will blow over in the coming months?
Well, first of all, I'd like to go on record and say I think Nigel De Jong is a very, very good player. I think that hasn't been said. I think, obviously, it's not really the time to be, you know, praising him. He has just gone out and ruined a fella's season, after all. But De Jong is very good at what he does. And 99.9% of what he does isn't flying into challenges recklessly and breaking people's legs. But what I would say is this. There is a physics to this particular issue. So we're going to go all scientific. Don your lab coats, listeners. The game has increased in pace and speed, and decisions have to be taken at a rate that has never, ever been forced upon players before. And there are some players who make good decisions and are able to process information rapidly and not go to ground in dangerous positions. And there are some players who don't, who just simply make poor decisions, who go to ground too easily, or who go to ground recklessly, or who just don't think about the welfare of the player who's going to be on the end of it, and think instead about the ball, which, after all, is what players are taught to do from a young age. It's, you know, if you're scared of the man, you know, you're not going to win the ball. That's what coaches always told me, and I'm a terrible footballer, so I'm no example. But anyway, players have now reached a stage in modern football where the whole paradigm has to change. That we are now looking at momentum, speed, and timing being so crucial that it no longer is the case that you can make bad decisions and get away with it. You make a bad decision, and with momentum and speed and timing, you will hurt somebody really badly. And I think that is ultimately what we're grappling with here. It's the nature of the game. It isn't the nature of the players. It's how the game has developed. And unfortunately, to come to a conclusion about this, that will necessitate changes in the way that players are coached. That will necessitate changes in the way that players are sent out to play on the field. Because we can't have players breaking other players' legs every week. It's upsetting, and it makes the game a less pleasant spectacle. And ultimately, without spectators, the game won't survive. So that's how I feel about it.
I think the funny thing is it's not happening every week. This is the thing. It happened last week. It's really unfortunate to Ben Arthur that he broke his leg. But it's football. Stuff. These things happen. It's not like we're coming off the back of a weekend where 9 players were maimed. It's one player in one incident, an incredibly unfortunate incident. And the thing is, if he jumps in the ridiculous 50-foot in the air way that the Wigan player did, he doesn't get hurt. It's the fact that he got his leg trapped, and it's those circumstances that does it. And
that's what made it a bad tackle.
Things are gonna sort of this happens. Action. It's not. I don't see it as a change in the game. I'd like to see stats on how many leg breaks there are now compared to.
They're interestingly more leg breaks in the Premier League than any other league in Europe or any of the other major leagues in Europe.
That's all them foreign pansies, isn't it?
I think there's
that was a joke. If the Equalities Commissioner listening.
There is definitely an element in those statistics of the pace of the game, because actually I don't think all of the broken legs that I can remember have been down to really, you know, obviously deliberate malicious challenges. There have been lots that have been reckless and punished as such, but I don't think they've all been done with intent. Some of them have, and I think some of the recent ones have. Obviously not intent to maim, but there's been, you know, undertones of I'm taking the ball and the man here, and I think they apply to the 2 tackles over the weekend. I disagree with Sam over the De Jong tackle. I think Carl Henry's tackle was just as bad. I think they were shocking tackles.
It's still probably coming in right now. It was that late.
they were appalling, and there is decision making too, obviously. But I think there are players who are unnecessarily aggressive.
If De Jong was sent off, do you think we'd still be talking about this now?
I think the fact that there were two would mean that we would be, but obviously we would probably take a slightly different slant on the thing. It would make a difference if he had been.
Do you think, Chris, that people, that the Premier League might start coming round to the view that Arsene Wenger has been espousing, whether you agree with it or not?
I don't think there's that much they can do about it, really. I think there is a coaching point that needs to be made, but I don't think there's that much you can do. The rules are there. The rules are not being applied correctly in the case of De Jong, and are being applied correctly in the case of Henry. You cannot tackle recklessly. You can't tackle dangerously, and you can't tackle with excessive force. And you know, these rules cover the tackles that we're talking about.
There's one thing. I was chatting to Chris Applegate at the weekend, who's been a guest on the pod before, and he was talking. It is, as I mentioned earlier, about percentages, and a different percentage at a different time might result in a different result in terms of the tackle on there. But also, I mean, it's kind of, some of it's lucky and some of it's unlucky, because probably the worst case you can think of a broken leg was David Boost from Coventry, and that was completely and utterly accidental.
Yeah.
On there.
Oh, Valencia. These things as well.
Exactly. But then on the other hand, you know, you look at stuff in terms of the red cards as well. Everybody saying Joe Coles at the start of the season was unfair. To me, that was a justifiable one, not because it made any lasting damage on Koscielny, but because of the recklessness about it, that even if he wasn't that type of player, which I don't think Cole is, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I don't think Cole is that type of player, but he becomes that type of player for a moment when he goes in recklessly.
I don't think you can judge the red card on the immediate outcome, because I think it's about the intention, it's about the rules of the game, not what happens to the player who's on the receiving end of the bad tackle. What can be done is, in very obvious cases, or even cases that are a bit marginal but where they were absolutely needlessly reckless, you can look at them and you can extend the ban. I wouldn't go for they should be out for the season or they should be out for as long as the victim is injured. But you can add a couple of games to these guys, and it probably wouldn't do anything about it, because for so many of them, it is actually in the nature of the way they play. They're probably not nasty guys, but a lot of them play that way, and it's going to lead to them injuring somebody quite badly.
I mean, just to tie that in and hopefully try and amplify the point that I was making, to not make myself look like some kind of nutty liberal, I do agree with your point. It's actually that 20 years ago, of course, there were players who went out with the same mentality as players like De Jong do, which is, you know, play hard and play fair, and, you know, the consequences, what will be, will be. Actually, now, as I say, the game has changed, the physicality and the speed has meant that you can't just go out on the field and say, well, I'll throw myself around as long as I get the ball, you know, it's fine, because they will cause injury, whereas I don't think 20 years ago they would have done in quite the same way.
I should try playing ice hockey. Okay, well, this isn't usually the time we do MLS, but there's no time in part two, so we shifted it to our distinctly international flavour of part three, as with the Euro qualifiers as well. In the meantime, here's Carl Douglas' thoughts on the discussion of bad tackles. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as light. Part three of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Chris Nee, if you're a Seattle fan, what would you be feeling right now?
Embarrassment and shame, but also a little bit of pleasure in winning the US Open Cup again.
So why the embarrassment and shame, first of all?
Oh, Rafe Green.
Other than that, on the pitch.
Yes, their second consecutive US Open Cup win in their second year as an MLS team. So pretty impressive. Beat Columbus was a couple of nights ago now, in the final of the US's somewhat bizarre cup competition. But yeah, it's another cracking achievement. It's silverware, and it's a group of supporters who seem to be quite pleased with that silverware, even though their playoff hopes probably aren't up where they'd like them to be.
I'll just explain briefly for somebody who doesn't quite understand what the US Cup is. Can you just explain? It's not kind of like the FA Cup, but it's probably the nearest thing they've got.
Yeah, it is a little bit like the FA Cup. You do meet smaller teams, but there are so many strange qualifying systems, and they bid to host the games as well. It's not a straight home or away draw. They sort of bid to have it. So DC United have played their last sort of 10 ties at home, including the final last year in which they were beaten by Seattle. And Seattle hosted the final this week. So there are strange systems around it, but essentially it is the domestic cup of US and Canadian football.
And a good week for Seattle also. They beat Toronto as well. In the sort of a general table, that leaves them, well, if you combine them together, sixth.
Yeah, it leaves them sixth. They are, like most of the teams in the playoff places now, basically home and dry. The playoff picture's pretty much settled, I would say. So they're gearing up for their second year in the playoffs as a second year club, which is another impressive achievement.
Hey, DC won.
Yes, it doesn't happen very often, and it very rarely matters, but they have potential, after beating the Rapids, to actually put the spoilers on a couple of teams going for the playoffs. But as I say, it's so kind of set in stone now that it'll be difficult for them to do so. But they don't do particularly well traditionally at Colorado, so that win's quite enjoyable one. And good to see Danny Alsop on the score sheet, because he hasn't had that many this year.
Of course, the Wizards still kind of, you could say, hanging in there in terms of an outside chance. They'd have to put a run together though, and not helped by losing at New York Red Bulls, although no shame to losing to the Red Bulls either.
No shame, bit of a drab performance from the Wizards. They conceded a really early goal, and there was just no way back for them. The Red Bulls are gearing up pretty nicely. They're keeping a bit of momentum about them. The Galaxy now are picking up momentum as well, after seeming to lose it a little bit. So it looking like a really exciting postseason.
And the Galaxy, Beckham got a winner for them.
Yeah, great finish. Scored a free kick from, you know, 20 yards. put it in the corner that you wouldn't expect. It got a bit of a... It probably could have been saved by a better goalkeeper, but it was well struck, and it was good to see him on the score sheet. And, yeah, he's eventually 10 men, the Galaxy, after Eddie Lewis is sending off. But the Chivas aren't up to much at all this season, so it's no surprise whatsoever that they took their place back at the top.
Mm, Columbus is stuttering a little bit, though. The Crew drawing... Can anyone mention Gold's draw with the Earthquakes?
Yeah, we're talking about momentum, and the Crew probably are the one team that's really starting to dip a little bit and probably just trying to cruise into the playoffs. But they might find it difficult. They went out in the first round of the playoffs last season, and I wouldn't be surprised if they did the same again.
Mm, and then looking for the fixtures ahead this week, the Wizards have to beat the Sounders, you've got to say, if they wanted to keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. They need to do it. They're probably going to find it difficult, but Seattle obviously are on a bit of a high, so you never know which way that's going to go. They might be still hung over, or they might be on the crest of a wave. But it's absolutely must-win for the Wizards.
Mm. Red Bull's playing Rail Salt Lake, which should be a good game.
Yeah, fighting out at the top of the Galaxy, though, still. I think there's quite a few people are not surprised to see Rail Salt Lake up at the top, but they actually took over briefly at the top of the combined table at one point last week, and I think that probably is a bit of a surprise after the Galaxy's storming start to the season. And have a quick look at the Red Bull squad as well. Rail Salt Lake have really... done pretty well to be right up at the top, and it's going to be a really interesting game, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them win it.
Mm. Do you think DC can put together a back-to-back win? Not that it matters, but they have San Jose at home.
Hell no. The Earthquakes are a good side. Obviously went to Columbus and drew, which isn't that easy, and DC are very, very poor.
Right, okay. Optimism as always there.
Yeah, well, Napoli are taking up all my optimism at the moment.
Just before we get on to the international game, a quick question thrown out. Anybody want to answer this? Should David Sullivan really be encouraging EastEnders and West Ham fans to riot if they don't get the Olympic Stadium? That was from Narrow the Angle. Anybody got an opinion on that?
Nobody listens to him.
Are you trying to say that West Ham fans need any encouragement to riot? I seem to recall that, you know, it doesn't really take much. Anyway,
yes.
You think they'd be more concerned about their performances on the pitch at the moment.
Mm, indeed. Well, short and pithy and sweet. MLS continues this weekend, as we mentioned there. International qualifiers return, though. No England. They got Montenegro next week because of the uneven number of teams in their group. We might well see a first appearance for 33-year-old Kevin Davies. Sam, what did you make of the Bolton strikers' call-up?
Bizarre. Really indicative of how poor English strikers are at the moment. I mean, Capello came out after the World Cup and said, yeah, okay, this is the time that we're going to remove the ageing Deadwood from the squad and give the younger players a go, and now he's calling up a 33-year-old to likely sit on the bench because he's quite clearly the fourth choice striker in that group. I don't see the benefit of it. I mean, why not call up a younger player who can even just have the experience of being with the squad and players that, you know, they'd likely be playing with in 2 years' time?
Mm. Geordie, though, you've got to admit that he has been very consistent. And when you look at all the players that are out of the England squad at the moment, all the strikers are out through injury, the long-term like Zamora or short-term like a Bonglahor, then perhaps it makes sense because he's quite easy to drop. Nobody's going to be calling for Kevin Davies' return.
They should all be easy to drop.
But can you imagine if Capello dropped Rooney, even if he's not playing particularly well, or Capello...
Which I think he should have done, incidentally, Gary, but do carry on.
But then if he drops Kevin Davies, he might get sort of a few minutes here and there. If he does well, good chance to stake a claim, at least to help out during qualifying. He's probably not going to complain too much because he's got, he's got himself caps when he probably wasn't expecting it. And then at the end of the day, nobody's going to go, oh, blimey, why has he dropped Kevin Davies for XYZ?
Yeah, but it's a bit of a ridiculous situation if the England manager is... He obviously has been, but, I mean, the England manager shouldn't be worried about what people are going to say to him about his team selections. He should pick the best players, the most informed players that he can. I mean, it's nice that he's looking outside of the usual suspects, but not that he's looking at Kevin Davies. I mean, I had a quick look at his profile on the squad list on the FA website earlier, and it said something about, I can't remember it verbatim, but it said something about his hard work has always seen him rewarded with 8 or 9 goals a season. Well, that's brilliant, isn't it? I had a look and he's averaged a goal every 4.5 games at Bolton. He's not... I was about to say he's not good enough for England, but yeah, what am I talking about? He's exactly good enough for England.
See, I will disagree, actually. I am a very big fan of Kevin Davies. I think he is an excellent player who is much underrated, yet he's very physical. I don't think he's going to cope particularly well at international level.
I think that's exactly... You look at how Crouch struggles on the international scene in terms of how refs view his size and physicality. He gives free kicks away every 30 seconds, and now you're talking about bringing in the player who commits the most fouls in the Premier League year in, year out, and getting him to lead the line international game. Now, if he's committing that many fouls in the Premier League, you put him in an international game where he touches another player and the ref's going to blow a whistle. I can't see how he's going to get on there.
We're right back, aren't we, to lumping the ball up to an ageing big man and doing what we need to do to get through qualifying for the next tournament. And it just flies in the face of everything that people were saying after the World Cup about looking to the future, comparing ourselves to the Germans. And just saying, I mean, I personally would like to think that we would forget every tournament until 2018 in terms of winning it. We'd love to qualify for them all, but I think we should be looking to the future because we know that this short-termism hasn't worked. And, you know, Heskey up to that point, Kevin Davis, even Zamora, smacks of that short-termism. We should be looking to bring through younger players. And I don't think he's going to play, and I think he deserves his call-up, and I like him a lot. But it worries me that the World Cup failure has already been forgotten, and we're back to trying to get 3 points as we go and get up to the next tournament where we'll flop and we'll be introspective afterwards, and then we'll go back to it again afterwards.
Are you going to call up Davies? Are you going to call up some striker who's never had a young striker on a Premier League books who hasn't really had a sniff of first team action?
In terms of
experience and leadership that he brings. James, we've got kind of a slightly negative on here. Are you going to back me up at all on Davies, or are you going to pile in like a Davies tackle?
I don't disagree on Davies at all. I think he's a cracking player at what he does. I don't think that's what England should be doing tactically, and I don't think that his age is conducive to what I want England to be.
It's amazing how I did that with my voice, isn't it? Anyway, I do think Davies is a great call-up, but not for the reasons that anyone's actually suggested. I agree with Gary. He's really easy to drop, and therefore it's a free pass for Capello, basically. You know, he doesn't have to make a decision on anybody. He just calls up Davies and then drops him again. But I actually think that, and hear me out, the England team need more players like Kevin Davies, right? And we need fewer players like John Terry and Steven Gerrard and, you know, the other flash guys with the big headphones and the diamond-encrusted mobile telephones. Kevin Davies brings a certain amount of intelligence and careful thought and good, honest, professional approach.
Point the elbows.
I don't care about what he does on the field. For all I care, Capello can not give him a pair of boots and tell him that he just has to hang around the dressing room talking to the players. Because to be honest, it's the influence of somebody who, you know, has really worked hard in his career and has always had to be, a professional and not necessarily always had to rely on, oh well, I'm a good player, even though I just go out and do whatever the hell I like on a, you know, Saturday night, drinking and getting into fights and splashed all over the front pages of the tabloids. I remember it wasn't so long ago Sven-Göran Eriksson called up Chris Powell, and obviously a lot of eyebrows were raised. It didn't last long. I think he got 8 caps 9 caps. But it's good for players in the England setup to experience that, to have other players around them who, you know, have had to work hard. I think that those sort of players bring a different vibe to the dressing room, and it's not, it makes clear that it's not, you know, a closed shop, and it isn't that they're going to be pampered the whole time. That's why I support Davies's call.
I agree with that. I agree that that sort of fundamental change is needed in the England side, but.
What a shame he's 23.
Are you saying that Kevin Davies is going to walk into that dressing room and everyone's going to respect you? You think that John Terry and Steven Gerrard are going to shut up because Kevin Davies tells them to?
I wouldn't pick a fight with Kevin Davies.
I don't think Kevin Davies is going to throw his weight around that dressing room. But I think it's about a culture change. I mean, the problem is that I was racking my brains to think, well, who else could Capello bring up who's of that sort? And I thought, well, Scott Parker, maybe. Scott Parker's another one who, you know, he's a good, honest pro. You know, he gives all these cliches, gives 100% every week, and he's a good, honest club man. But honestly, you know, we need more of those players in the England
setup. I completely agree with you, but I don't think bringing in one player is, that's not a culture shift.
It's not, but it is the start of a culture shift that I would like to see. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't even know whether that's Fabio Capello's, you know, fundamental philosophy behind calling up Kevin Davis. It's just something that occurred to me. It's just nice to see him there, and I'd like to think that players will talk to him and listen.
He's still a crap footballer.
If you're talking about that kind of culture change, then what you want is Joey Barton to go in and tell them that they're all knobs again.
And then stub out a cigar in each of their eyes.
Yeah, yeah. You don't even have to put him in the squad, though. You can just wheel him in just for a chat and then send him back off.
Ultimately, no disrespect to Montenegro, but they are, what, the 33rd ranked team in Europe? If we can't experiment and put the odd kid on the pitch and start trying to bring them through, then we shouldn't bother with the next tournament. We should go on now.
We should be doing it anyway, even if they were a different
country. You can't beat Montenegro with a couple of 18-year-olds on the field and pack up and go on.
I think I'd actually agree more with bringing up Kevin Davis if I thought he was going to play. I think half my problem with him being there is the fact that I see it as a bit pointless.
It's quite patronising in a way, isn't it? Like, you're old, you're not going to be playing for that much longer. Come and have a day out with the England squad. Yeah.
And amidst all that, as you mentioned, England are playing Montenegro. James, they are joint top of the group, though, 6 points, former Yugoslav Republic. Never going to be a particularly easy game, but you'd expect England to win.
I would expect England to win, but sorry, Chris, let's not underestimate Montenegro here. I actually was researching for a piece about Montenegro early in the week. Had Montenegro been an independent nation for the last 30 years, Dejan Savicevic, former AC Milan player, and Predrag Mijatovic, formerly of Valencia and Fiorentina and notably Real Madrid, scorer of the winning goal in a Champions League final, would have turned out for Montenegro. And they've got some great players. Mirko Vucinic of Roma is really, you know, a top guy. There's Stevan Jovetic, who won't be playing, but is a Fiorentina player who unfortunately has got a knee injury, which is going to keep him out for a while. But they do produce talent, and Balkan teams, without sounding like I'm generalising, do play good football. They're technically very gifted. They're also quite physical. They tend to throw their weight around quite a lot, and I think England might be in for a bit of a shock. They have shot up from 199th in the world when they were registered as a FIFA nation in 2007 to 64th in the world this week. So they're a lot better than people are giving them credit for sure.
Hmm. I think Mirko Vucinic is probably better than any single player we have in our squad, with the possible exception of Rooney on form.
Well, Jack Wilshere, I would possibly say, in the form that he's been in so far.
Yeah.
Possibly. Or Adam Johnson as well. Anyway, other international games going on. It's not all about England.
Of course it is.
Don't let Harry Redknapp in.
Scotland. They've got the Czech Republic away, and then they've got Spain, both of which are interesting games, Sam.
The Czech Republic game, I hadn't actually thought about the Czech Republic game, I just thought they were playing Spain. So I've only actually thought about Spain. So nothing to say on the Czech Republic. But the Spanish game will actually be, I think that's going to be an interesting game with the number of players that the Spanish are missing. No Xavi, no Fabregas, no Torres, no Pedro. I wrote down the list of the players they're missing. No Jesus Navas. So not that they're ever going to be there for the taking, but I think if there's ever going to be a time that Scotland can get a result against Spain, it's going to be next week.
But they had then, well, do you think they've kind of might use that horrific result last time around, or near horrific result against Liechtenstein, to actually motivate themselves? Do you think Craig Levein might go, well, look, we hit a low there, we can't get any lower, we've got Czech Republic, decent side, we've got the world champions, let's go out and get a bit of pride, if nothing
else.
Yeah,
I think they need to go for it. I mean, no one expects Scotland to get results against Spain, and why not use now as a platform to go for it? If they lose 4-0, you know, no one's really going to think it's a national disaster, so why not?
I'd like to point out as well, Scotland have former Exeter City striker Jamie Mackey called up for the first time. He's been in scintillating form for QPR and he's come a long way, hasn't he, since the conference back in those days. What else we've got? We've got Wales against Bulgaria. Brian Flynn, his first caretaker game in charge, will be very interesting to see. But no Craig Bellamy, no Robert Earnshaw. Bulgaria, not particularly brilliant. I could see this one turning out to be a draw, frankly. And then they've got Switzerland, which I don't give us a hope in hell about beating Switzerland at all. Certainly Bulgaria's the one to target. Not that Wales are actually going to qualify remotely from there. If we're looking for interesting fixtures, though, Chris, Portugal-Denmark.
Very tough for Portugal. They're not in the best shape generally in international football over the last year or so. Denmark, as we've seen, very, very good side. So, yes, I suppose you might get Portugal put down as favourites for that one, but I certainly don't see it that way.
And if Portugal don't win that one, I mean, I know it's slightly hyperbolic to say they might not be, that's it, that's their qualifying done, but they would have such a huge mountain to climb, to use a cliche.
If they lose, I think they're done for. I think I might have said that before their last game as well, actually.
You might have done. Yeah, difficult to write them off on there. To me as well, I mean, I don't know if anybody's got any opinion on this, but I think Germany-Turkey is possibly also... you look at the top of that group, you're nodding like a Churchill dog over there, James, at that.
Oh, yes. Germany-Turkey. Gus Hiddink, tactical master, playing Germany, who, obviously, we all know about Germany, played a brilliant World Cup. That is going to be great. And not only that, but... it's every time Germany and Turkey play one another, that Germany being the country with the largest expatriate Turkish population, there's always a bit of needle. There's going to be great atmosphere. It's going to be a fantastic game, nice and open. And I have the feeling that Hiddink might just get one over on Germany with this one.
And of course, you've also got Mesut Ozil, who is Turkey's or could have qualified for Turkey and has ended up playing for Germany. Attracted some criticism for Turkey for that. And then on the other side in Turkey, Siren, who the Dortmund player, who is fantastic talent.
He's got a cracking free kick at the weekend.
He did indeed. He's an excellent young player who could have played for Germany and has opted for Turkey. So yeah, I could have even put that one down in this week's six picks, Chris.
I like the look of Italy-Serbia as well on a Tuesday night.
Yeah, no,
particularly considering how Italy aren't exactly firing on all cylinders at the moment.
Do you reckon that one could be one for Serbia then?
It could be. It's not exactly a bad time to be playing the Italians, so I think that's going to be an interesting tie to have a look at.
Well, the Italians might be going into that one having dropped points against Northern Ireland. I mean, I happen to think Northern Ireland are the one home nation that really are very, very good at punching above their weight, and you know, we're going to see tomorrow night, Friday night, sorry, whether Northern Ireland can take a few points off Italy, and I wouldn't bet against them.
His name is team Prandelli for tomorrow. I can't remember who he's in it, but the one name that does stick out, of course, is Mr. Cassano.
Has he got a game, is he?
Yeah, he's been he has been firing for Italy, and he guided them to the good results they've had so far. I think it's going to be a fascinating game. I think that Northern Ireland will take some unlocking. I think Italy probably just about have the players to do it.
Really? Do you think Italy might carry on as they have been in the past, struggling through their qualifications, not particularly impressing? Or do you think there's any cause for optimism that things might improve from their last few showings?
I will sit on the fence, but I think there's plenty of cause for optimism. I don't see why you would assume that they're not going to. They are bringing in slightly younger players and some of the players who've been previously possibly unfairly overlooked, and they have a manager who loves to play excellent football, and hopefully that should be enough to beat most of the teams that they will come across in qualifying.
Should we go for one last one of Ireland against Russia?
Get your money on a home win on that one. Russia are going into this game under a lot of pressure. They got beaten in Moscow against Slovakia last time out. Gus Hiddink, that's another Freudian slip there, to go along with the others, the collection today. Dick Advocaat, manager of Russia, has been the grumpiest anyone's ever seen him this week, and he's always very, very grumpy. He's under pressure already. He had a hard act to follow with Gus Hiddink, and his players not really performed for him. And if there's one area of that game that I'll be keeping an eye on, it's Robbie Keane. Excuse you again.
Sorry.
Robbie Keane, running at the Russian centre backs, Berezutsky, probably Vasily Berezutsky. There's two of them. There's twins, and Sergei Ignashevich, who both 6 foot three, and both have the turning circle of a small tractor. So. I think that's where the game's going to be won and lost.
Like, Robbie Keane also has a turning circle of perhaps a slightly smaller tractor as well.
Yeah, but he's good. When he celebrates, he runs really fast.
Yeah, I think that's just about it. I was going to put down for Geordie to talk about Belarus and Albania, but I think we're out of time for that.
Go on.
Okay, all that remains for me, thank Chris Geordie White, thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
James Appel, thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
Sam Kaur, thank you.
Pleasure, thanks.
Before I go to Chris, I'll just quickly... I am going to thank you. I'll just plug your website in various different ways. Twitter.com/twofootattackle if you want to get in touch with Chris at any point on Twitter. Facebook.com/twofootattackle if you want to become a fan of the show and leave us any comments there. www.twofootattackle.com. Loads of great content there from loads of different writers. Kirsten Schreilitz this week writing about Seattle Sounders win. Many other bits and pieces as well. Do go check it out. Email podcast@twofootattackle.com if you've got any questions for next week's pod, which I believe involves ITV.com's Luke McLaughlin. And if that's not enough to wet you whistle, I don't know what is. Chris, thank you very much.
Cheers.
And thank you, listener.
Twofootedtackle.com.
I was trying to get some prescription sunglasses and I couldn't find the ones that fit my face. Like, I have got quite a small head. And goes, yay, you have, it's really small. Right.